Okay, well, we're going to start with a word of prayer and then do a little review and then see where we are. And we're going to try to get through up to the section. I'm going to try to get to where we're going to talk about how when Rome transitions from being pagan to Constantine says, hey, guess what? We're Christian now. We're trying to get to that point and then let Curtis take over where it says Latin Vulgate, because I started looking into. And that was a whole mess of information, and I just wasn't, it just wasn't clicking yet. So that's where we're going to try to be. So if you would, let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we come to you at the beginning of this period of worship and study that where we're looking into how we got your word and how we have the information that we have from you and how we are to live our lives. We hope that as we read through it as a faith-building effort, exercise, it is something that creates in us a love for your word and a love for the history behind it. And a love for those who compiled it and helped to make sure that your word is spread. We hope that you'll be with those that aren't with us because they're sick. Be with those that are struggling with constant infirmities, that you could be with them and comfort them and offer them aid as they go through a troubling time in life. We hope that you'll be with those that chose not to be here, that they could see that studying your word is what is good in life and can lead to an amazing life, an amazing time studying and learning about your word. We hope that you'll be with us as we continue and into the worship period this day, and that we can do so in a manner that is well-pleasing to you. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen. Okay, so what did we talk about Wednesday night? What did we get into? I did a little review always. Somebody give me something that stands out to them. You know, it's the one thing. If you walked out of the class that when you walked out, you said, you know what? I learned that. Somebody. Anybody? Nobody? Okay, well, I guess I'll start it off. I always enjoy looking at the Apocrypha. That's sort of neat, those extra books that aren't in the Bible but are still in some of, like, Catholic Bibles or all those, the Orthodox Bible. Those are just interesting to look at those. Today we're going to get more into, you know, why did they leave some of those things out, and why did some of that stuff get sort of just, you know, kicked out and said, you know, this is not authoritative, this is not inspired, whereas this is. This is the slide we ended on, and we talk about the law of Moses, prophets, and Psalms, refer to the three sections of the Hebrew Bible as it would have been organized. You know, we have the two things. Whenever I think about the two testaments, I always think about the kids when they learned it, they said the New to Old Testament and the New Testament, and they clapped their hands together. But there was a CD we listened to how they said it. You know, you always hear it that way. But they actually would have been divided by law of Moses, prophets, and Psalms, just a little bit different than we're used to it. And we have it broken down to our books, okay? They would have chunked their books. So we're going to go to the next one. So one of the big deals about how they decide where things are going to be is, can you tie it back to an eyewitness? And that's one of the things I want you to remember as we go through this course. A lot of the books that are going to say, that the early church members are going to say, no, it's going to be because they can't be tied back to an eyewitness. Okay, they're written by people, or there are arguments about whether they're written by the right people and whether they're authoritative. And there's some more to it, but that's going to be one of the big key things that we're going to look for. And so we're going to get the books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I'm going to tell you, this is one of those like moments as I'm sitting reading this. And one thing, I showed you this book last time. This book is the one that we're sort of using as our guidebook to go with this one. It has a table that shows which books were written first. And as a kid, you always assumed which books got written first. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's not how it worked, right? I thought that was interesting. One of the things he goes into in this book, he talks about how one of the first book written was probably, I got to look at the chart because I'm going to say it wrong. The first book written... I gotta find the chart. Hold on one second. I bookmarked everything but that. Was it James? Yeah, there we go. Kind of Curtis. I'm glad Curtis is here because I can always say, hey, was this? And he can give me the thumbs up. Yeah, so James is actually written first. And so that's written before we actually have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so I think that's interesting that. So what are they referring back to? Because, you know, we all the epistles always refer back to what? the teachings of Christ, right? And so he's writing the letter based off of what? What do they have at that point? Anybody know? What's that? Oral history. There we go. We're going to go to the next one. This one. Is this it? Wrong one. Sorry. But, sorry, when I upsized everything, it rearranged it a little bit. And so I got to make sure I'm looking at the right thing. Yeah, so the followers of Jesus are going to write letters and epistles to the churches and to individual Christians. Which, does anybody know what book is written to an individual Christian? What's that? Second, third John. And then also, what's that? Philemon. Yeah. And so, but they're written by Paul, Peter, John, and others. And then an apocalypse, that's a great word. I love the word apocalypse, known as Revelation written by John. An apocalypse just means revelation. Yeah. So there's a lot of people want to put different words on it and spin it around, but that's it. Yeah, and so what they're used to is they lived in an oral culture, okay? Not everybody was literate. We determined that everybody in this room, except for probably the little baby right there, is literate. And we all know how to read. And we all know how to write. And so we can record what we want, right? And it's interesting because when you look, history, the study of history really takes off when you get writing. And then when the common person gets to write, that's when when instead of just big name history, which is like Washington, Jefferson, Adams, when the common man starts to write, you get what we call, what I like to call little idea history. You get those personal histories, right? They lived in a culture where not everybody could write, and so it was oral stories, right? You would talk to each other. You would tell the stories. You would get together and somebody would say, hey, I saw this, here we go, and lay it out. And then they would say, okay, great, that's neat. And then somebody else would lay it out. Now, what's interesting about that, that's going to be a skeptic's claim is, you know what, it's oral history. It's not accurate. But we got three things that can actually fix that, right? And the three things are, they're so used to having to do that and to tell those stories over and over again that they are able to do that, right? They have the capabilities and the capacity to remember these stories as they tell them. Okay, that's number one. That's the number one thing that's going to help them. The second thing that's going to help them is they work together to actually make sure that if somebody is wrong, that they fix it. Okay? So if me and Greg are talking, and I say, you know what, and we're first century Christians, we were there with our disciples, and we walked with Christ, and we talked to our congregation, we say, you know what, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. Greg's not going to be shy about saying, wait a second, your third this happened, I think you've got it wrong. And then we'll converse and figure it out, and he'll be like, and we're like, oh yeah, you're right. And we would correct each other and make sure our oral traditions would continue. Right, but instead of just the two of us, it would be multiples, three, four, five people doing this. And we actually have letters where you have I can't remember the name of the guy, but it's a letter where they talked about, you know what, we got together, we wrote it. It's not an inspired letter, it's from an early Christian, where they say, we discussed this and so was wrong. So we got this. And I'm going to tell you a little story about a guy that does that here later. And then you know what, they also had eyewitnesses. When the original books are going to be written, they're going to have eyewitnesses where if somebody is repeating a story, if I hadn't been there, but I'm repeating a story that an eyewitness had told me, you're going to have another eyewitness that's going to be able to say, hey, wait a second. You know what? At the Sermon on the Mount, he really didn't say that. He said something like this. Okay, so you're going to have three ways to sort of keep those stories true. Also, what we're going to notice is it's the consistency of the Bible. That when Paul says one thing, he's going to be writing his letters over the space of decades. He's going to be consistent in what he says Christ said over the course of that. Now, the style changes a little bit, but, I mean, whose style hasn't, if anybody writes substantially, your style changes as you get older, right? Curtis, do you write the same way you did when you started 30-something years ago or however long? I don't, and I've only been teaching 14 years, and I completely changed my style. And my students, I see my 7th grader style change a lot, from not so great to a little better by the end of the year. So yeah, style changes is another one of those skeptical claims of, well, the style's different. Are you sure it's the same guy? Well, people write different as they get older. So that's oral culture. That's how a lot of it's going to spread. That's how they spread pretty much everything. Once again, why? Because people can't read and a lot of people can't write. Okay? So any questions there before I sort of move on to some... a little bit more. Okay. clicked the wrong one. So all of the books, they're going to quote from all but eight of the old Hebrew and Aramaic Old Testament. Okay, what language is it written in? Is the original New Testament written in? What's that? Greek. It's going to be written in Greek, and then we're going to actually get into that here in a second. Now, some of it could have been written in Aramaic too, but what we're pretty sure is the originals were Greek. Wrong one. So we call it the New Testament and the Old Testament, right? It's sort of like, anybody ever heard the old brain teaser? A guy walks into an antique store, says, "This is my grandfather's sword from World War I. And you can tell because it's carved World War I. It's from 1918. It's authentic. And the antique dealer says, "No, it's not." And how do you know? How does he know? Because in 1918, they didn't know about World War. Yeah, they're like, "What's this World War I you're talking about? Where's two?" You know, so we know that. So where do they get New Testament, Old Testament? They wouldn't call it the Old Testament because right then it's there. It's there, right? And so we get the New Testament. And I thought this was sort of interesting. And I'd always heard this, but getting to dig into it a little more. We're going to look at Jeremiah 31 through 34 real quick. If you want to turn there, we're going to camp out there for a second. Jeremiah 31, right before the teacher's favorite book of Laminations. Sorry, bad joke. Somebody laughed at least, thanks. It's Lamentations. Just get that right. But Jeremiah 31, 34. So Jeremiah starts saying in 27, I'm actually going to start in 27. "And behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. And I have watched over them to pluck up, to break down, to overthrow, to destroy, and to bring disaster. So I will watch over them to build and to plant, declares the Lord." So Jeremiah is saying to his people, hey, God destroyed, he hurt, he tore down, he did this, he punished us. But what is he going to do in the end? He's going to build them up and to plant, right? And what is this? Is obviously a reference to who? Anybody? It's Christ. It's going to be a Christ reference. So he's talking about we're going to build up and go there. Because are the Jews going to ever be a big, huge thing again? In the point of Laman, at where he's at in Jeremiah? No, not at this point. "In those days," and then I'm in 29, "in those days they will not say again, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. But everyone will die for his own iniquity. Each man who eats the sour grapes, his teeth will be set on edge. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, where I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." And that's where they pull the idea from. Because all of these Christians would have been at least knowledgeable of what? Of the Old Testament, correct? They would have been knowledgeable of all these teachings, and they would have known this. And so that's where we're going. So in 32 he says, "Not like the covenant which I made with the fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. They will not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity and their sin, and I will remember no more." So we're getting into a lot. There's a lot there to unpack. A lot that has to do with how the Old Testament worked versus how the New Testament's going to work. How the old sacrifices would have not really... Did they forgive the sins, or did they just sort of... What's that? Yeah, just pushed them aside. And so he's saying this is going to be different. And so the Christians are going to pull this idea of the new covenant, and that's where they're going to get the idea of the New Testament and new Christians. And we have writings of that called the New Covenant from some early church leaders as early as the 100s is what we know from that, where it's going to be called that. Okay, and then the early translations. We're going to look at is the New Testament was written in Greek language, okay? So Greek, it is the lingua franca, it's what everybody would speak. It's what everybody who is literate would read and write if you're educated. Now, there are other written languages that are floating around, but it's the majority of people. If you're going to learn a language, you're going to learn to read and write in Greek. Okay, that's the educational language of the day. But we already, as early as the 200s and 300s, we are going to have some translations, because we're going to have the Coptics are going to be the first, are going to be one of them. The Coptics are Egyptian. We figured out that Coptic was a language. It disappeared and then it came back. It was a form. It was one of the languages on the Rosetta Stone. Anybody ever seen the Rosetta Stone? Never seen it. I've seen a bunch of pictures of it. I'd love to go see it. But the Rosetta Stone had, if I remember right, I should, but I don't. It had hieroglyphics, Coptic, and was it Greek as well? I couldn't remember, but yeah, Greek. So it had all three of them, and it really helped us to actually figure out how to translate Coptic and figure out how to do hieroglyphics. It was found by Napoleon and his soldiers during their campaign in Egypt. But Coptic is going to be one of those things. It's a dead language at this point. People don't speak it anymore, except for sometimes they'll use it in their liturgical or in their worship services in Egypt. Okay? There may be a few people that speak it here and there, but it's functionally a dead language. And then you're also going to have it in Syriac, which is Syrian, and that's in ancient Syria. Now, just as my curiosity to myself, if you ever want to hear what these sound like, you can Google Syriac, and there's actually a guy who is, he's an immigrant out of Syria right now who is a monk in one of their monasteries, but he's fled the fighting that's there, and he's recorded a bunch of chants and some of their religious music in Syria, in Syriac, that they used in the Syriac church. Still, it's actually sort of interesting to hear it, because it's foreign. It's something you've never heard before, so it is sort of interesting to sort of hear that and get into that. And then the Coptic, you can see videos from the Coptic church, which is still a pretty large denomination in Egypt. So. You might remember why is a lot of the stuff that we're going to look at, these manuscripts and these things, why Egypt? Why is it that Egypt is where we find all this stuff from? Do you remember what we talked about last Sunday? Why? Okay, well, Alexandria, you'd think that, but what happened to the Library of Alexandria? Just burned down completely, lost, I mean, we lost manuscript after manuscript. I mean, the sum of ancient knowledge goes away. If it was still around, we would know so much more. But the reason it's Egypt is you got to go back to geography. I said I'm always going to throw geography at you. Manuscripts are brittle. Okay, anybody ever stored a book in your garage or a box of books in your garage, and it's maybe a little like a damp fall or a damp winter, and you go back out there, and what's wrong with them? Pages are all stuck together, sort of furry. I've opened a box of books before, and it's just completely all together. It's because of the moisture. Paper, vellum, parchment, all these things. Remember, they're organic material. Organic material is likely to degrade, even if you treat it with the talc and all this stuff. But in Egypt, it doesn't really rain. There is not a lot of the only water is where? It's in the Nile. Yeah, and if you've ever done that, play with Google Earth or Google Maps, and you look at the satellite pictures, Egypt is pretty much... Everybody, 99% of the population in Egypt lives within walking distance of the Nile, or driving distance now, or one of the offshoots because of the way they've dammed it up. And that dryness, completely, it's great. It's good for what you do. I worked at the Kentucky Museum once, and one of our manuscript storage rooms was always kept at like 0% humidity and about 84 degrees. And so on cold days, you'd go in there and you'd be like, ooh, this is nice. And then you'd walk out to the drafting museum because it preserves it. It treats the paper like it wants to be treated and lets it stay that way. Okay? Humidity is the devil as far as it goes to when you're trying to preserve manuscripts and artifacts. That was one of my jobs there, was I had to check the moisture levels 3 times a day. And if it was ever bad, I'd have to wheel out the dehumidifiers or the humidifiers if it wasn't just right. It's a lot to it. So, but you can look these up. I always encourage you, if you want to see something interesting, just to see what it was like. The Coptic church still exists. I don't know how many members. I looked for for a little bit there, but didn't see much on that. So how do you get, everybody's heard the canon, right? I always thought it was funny. When I was a kid, I always hear, you know, canonizing a saint. I just always immediately thought they're going to put them in a cannon and shoot them out of it, but it's not what it means. Canon is the Greek word, is from the Greek word referring to standard of faith. Okay? It actually means to measure, and the literal translation is to measure. And so canon is it accurate? Is it right? And we're going to figure out if a book that belongs in canon, it is authoritative. It's there. You with me on that so far? Great. Okay. So how do we know a book is canon? What we know is, and I can't remember, when was the council? I had it marked, the one where they actually laid out the books, where they say that's when they, Constantine calls a council, and that's when we're going to say, oh, that's when the books are made. And a lot of the skeptics say, well, Constantine said it's these books because he wanted to keep power. Yeah, yes and no. What we do know is that very early on in the first century, churches are going to have libraries. Okay, where did the early church meet? Houses, right? And so one of the things we're going to know is they're going to have copies of letters, and there's a they would have special backpacks made to carry these around. They'd have special cabinets, and all of your library would be housed in a wherever you would meet, most likely, and you would have copies of things. And what we know from writings back and forth is that early on, the early churches accepted Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John once they were written, and then the letters. It's not going to be until about the 300s that we're going to have official documentation of where things are. And there's a reason for that, because we all know Nero. What did Nero do to the Christians? Who did he blame the great? He blamed the great fire on them, right? And he persecuted. He did a lot of different the Christianity was a capital offense until 312, when you get the edict of tolerance, and then you're going to get next, it's going to be made the official religion by Constantine. So it's a capital offense. So one of the things that emperors were known to do was they would go to Christians and say, you know what, you're saying this, we don't believe this, you need to profess that the Caesar is the Lord, and that what would they do? No, we're not going to do that. And they would seize their property, right? Seize their property and usually either burn it down and destroy any records they'd have. And so that was actually pretty, because the thing is, the originals are called autographs. Remember we talked about that early on? We don't have any of those originals. The closest we have is the Ryland fragments, which are on papyrus and some chunks. But most likely they were destroyed when Christians would have their homes compounded and all of the different stuff destroyed. But still, continued on through oral tradition, all that good stuff. So, canon, to measure, remember that. And you'll hear that word quite a bit. I probably say in the Greek wrong, but here we go. Let's go on to the next one real quick. So the books of the New Testament. The ones that have seem to be, because we're pushing it together from fragments, that seem to be officially is the four Gospels, Acts, Paul's letters, and then at least one of John's letters. And some people are going to accept some, and some are going to accept others, but how do you decide? Because how do you decide that this one book, you know what, let's just say it's 3 John. How did they finally decide, you know what, let's put 3 John in there? Anybody got an idea? Nobody? So what this author says is, as they move forward through time and as they look and they do what are called, remember, we call them critical studies, as they look at text and they say, does this text line up to what the rest of the Bible says? Does it follow the pattern? Does it follow the rules? Does it follow what Christ said? Does it follow what Paul wrote about? Is it consistent? And if it's consistent, it would generally be accepted by more and more. And there are big arguments back and forth about this through correspondence that we see through history. And I'm going to tell you about one here in a second about Serapion, which I think I'm saying that right, and how he figures out, he actually says, yeah, let's study this, and then he sort of pulls back for a second. And it's an interesting cautionary tale about how they would have had to do things. So Paul's letters are there. Acts is there. The four Gospels are there. That's going to be something that as they move forward, they're going to say, does it line up to the things that everybody accepts? And nine times out of ten, or the whole time, it does. So we're going to look at that. So the Serapion guy that I was going to tell you about, it's an interesting, he's sort of got an interesting story. He is a church leader and in the second century. And this guy, it's in this book, he actually tells the story. He gets a letter from a church in, what region was it? Rhosas. Never heard of it. Should look it up, but I'm not sure where it is. And they say, we have this really cool book. And he's like, and they're fighting over, and he said, he sort of gets two stories. Part of them said, we got this really neat book. We should study it. And it's called the Gospel of Peter. Okay? And he says, okay, great. Then he gets another letter that says, you know what? Hey, this Gospel of Peter, we don't need to study it. Should we study it or should we not? And he answers them back and he says, you know what? If it's going to cause fighting, just study it and figure it out. And then he gets a copy of it and he reads it himself. And he, like, I can almost see an old guy in the second century going, and then turn the page. Because it's got some really weird stuff to it. It tells the story of the let me see if I can find where it says that. So it tells the story of the resurrection, except that it adds that a giant talking cross appeared, that when Christ rose, he like volcanoed out of the tomb, and that a giant talking cross came up and was talking to people. And so it tells some really things that, does it line up to the rest of the Gospels? No, it doesn't. And so he immediately, it's sort of interesting, he sort of does his double takes. He immediately writes a letter and says, by the way, stop studying this. And then it's such a big deal to him that he not only does that, he goes on sort of a tour to say, he immediately leaves. He writes the letter, sends it off to somebody, and then leaves the very same day to go around and say, this Gospel of Peter, we're not reading it. And so what the historians believe, we actually have some of Serapion's writings saved, is that between him and some of the people he's working with, is that they believe that the people who originally found the Gospel of Peter were pushing their ideas. And what they did was they wrote the Gospel of Peter, put Peter's name on it to make it a little more authoritative, and then pushed it to push their ideas, which are, we're not going to get into because it's a whole big study of authority and the Godhead and Trinity and all those things. And we have his writings. You can actually look them up. Some of them are transcribed on digitally, and you can take a look at his writings. And it's really interesting. But here's the thing. We have his writings that talk about the Gospel of Peter, but we didn't have the Gospel of Peter. And in 1886, what happens is they find the Gospel of Peter, and they finally have a copy of it to read it, and a lot of Christian scholars are like, I can totally see where this is completely weird. So in 1886, they get a copy of it, and it's sort of interesting. We're going to jump ahead in time to Constantine. Let's remember back to our world sieve. Constantine is known as Constantine the Great, okay? What's so great about him? There's a lot of stuff. Constantine is going to be emperor from 306. He's going to be emperor of, they have a what's called a tetrarchy, where there's three or four rulers at a time because it's so spread out. If you know about Rome, it's so spread out that it's going to hurt the empire. And so you have multiple leaders. And so what's going to happen is he's going to be emperor of the West in 306, and then he's going to fight a bunch of civil wars to be named emperor over the whole, okay? And so Constantine, interesting fact about him, his father was a military leader. His mother was a Greek, but we also know his mother was probably a Christian, okay, and had some knowledge of Christianity. Now, there are arguments among historians of whether Constantine was influenced by his mother to become a Christian, Or later in life, he realized that Christianity had a power to sort of control the empire, and he saw it as a what's called a realpolitik move, where he's going to use it to consolidate. We don't know. There's arguments, and they still argue about this. I found online there's a historians convention. I think it'd be cool. Curtis probably like it, but all of us probably, you all probably fall asleep. But they're still arguing over Constantine from 306. I mean, he's going to be emperor from 306 to 337 for 31 years. But whether or not he really was convinced to be a Christian because of that, or he just did it later for power. Okay. And so what's going to be interesting about him is a lot of people say, well, Constantine did this. Constantine, from the records we have of the, he calls a conclave in, when does he call it? Not conclave. He calls a group of people together at Nicaea, and they're going to issue statements of faith and all this stuff and agree on which books go where. And from the writings of it, we're pretty sure that Constantine had nothing to do with it. He just simply said, hey guys, you need to gather up and get some ideas and cement them all together. That's something we're spoiled by. And I want to take a little second and do a pit stop there. We know immediately what's happening in multiple churches around the world, right? Because we have email, we have phones, we have all this stuff. Back then, if you're in Alexandria and somebody says something wacky in your congregation, it's going to take how long for it to get back to somebody else? Months. It could be months before it gets over there and back, over to Jerusalem and back. Or even more, I mean, how long did it take Paul to get to Rome during his travels? So we're spoiled by the fact of, you know what, if, let's say, I don't think it's going to ever happen, but Curtis gets up there and he starts talking just some complete weirdness, I could immediately check in, like call, my dad is who I usually talk to religious stuff about. He's an elder up in Indiana. I'd be like, hey, Curtis said this. Is this something I should look into? And not immediately get an answer, right? Not an answer, authoritative answer, but I get an answer where I could look. And we could sort of get some things going on. We can figure out what's happening. And we can fix stuff pretty quick. Back then, couldn't do it. And it was really easy. Plus, everybody has a Bible in their hands, right? Remember, did the congregations have their own Bible? No, they would have had copies, maybe. They would have single books, but we're not going to have it compiled together. So we sort of got to think out in our historical lens to know, we as modern humans like to put our, think, oh, they just would have emailed each other and fixed it. No, they would have snail mailed it than this. Plus, we couldn't write about it, so we'd have to find somebody to write it out for us. And so that's something to think about as we go through it, that they're going to do some things. So Constantine calls this Council of Nicaea. They get together. They put together the books that we know. Constantine's also going to do some things. He's going to build quite a few churches and build church buildings. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Anybody ever been there and seen the Church of the Holy Sepulchre? Yeah, it is the traditional site of Christ's burial. And it's pretty, Greg said he's been there. It's interesting. That was built by Constantine when he starts making overt, he makes Christianity the legal religion. He says, you know what, we're not just going to tolerate it as the Edict of Tolerance says, we're going to actually make it the official religion of Rome, okay? And he goes on to build churches. He calls the Council of Nicaea, builds the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, does a whole bunch of other stuff. But then some historians will say he was actually only converted on his deathbed. There's no real knowing because there's so many different historical accounts of what he does. So is he a great guy? Well, by some standards, yes, because he sets up the Bible to sort of be solidified into what we see now. Okay, he sets the historical precedent that we're going to have this. So, any questions there, Constantine? I'm sort of glazing over. There's a lot more. I mean, we could do a whole 13 classes just on Constantine. He gets really interesting stuff going on. Anybody? Okay, so by the 400s AD, so we've actually talked about, we've gone from the zeros to the 400s. And this is something I always have to tell my seventh graders is they get stuck, and I even do it sometimes, when I read, when you read about the, so the 400s would have been what century? The 5th century. And I still do it in my head. When I read 400s, I think, oh, the 4th century. And then I'll read something else about the 4th century, and I'll be like, wait a second, that's not right. Yeah, you gotta go, because I always have to tell my kids, the zeros, that's the first. And so we're technically, we're in the 2000s, but we're in the 21st century, okay? And so you sort of have to do a little mental gymnastics to remind yourself, wait a second, I did that when I was reading about Constantine, because it talked about the 4th century and how Constantine in the 4th century did this, and then I flipped the page and it said something about 300s, and it just was completely... I will tell you, and this is my speech about sources. I know everybody hates Wikipedia and says it's a terrible source. For ancient history, Wikipedia is fairly reliable. Their authors are mostly PhDs, and if you want to dig into a little bit more, it's a good starting point. Like I would make sure you check your sources on it. But Wikipedia has some good overview information about these guys. Constantine, the article about Constantine is fairly well written. And it's actually a good place to start. I just tell my kids never cite it because then people think you look silly. But you can actually go down and you can see where the people cite the work from. And most of the time you can click on it and see the work itself that they cited. So what history texts and what historical information they're using. So 27 books are going to be traced to the testimony of apostolic eyewitnesses and their close associates. Okay? So remember how I said that? That is going to be one of the keys of, is it an eyewitness? So let's go with the four Gospels. Matthew, was he an eyewitness? Yes. Mark? Yes. Luke? Eyewitness? No. What was he? Anybody know who was Luke? What was Luke's job? He was a physician, but who was he an attendant to? Paul. And Peter. And so he wasn't a personal eyewitness, we can't confirm, but we do know that he was in contact with them, right? And so there's that connection that we're looking for. And then John, was John an eyewitness? Yeah, we have scriptural reference that says he wasn't just an eyewitness. I mean, he was one that reclined, right? He was there. Peter, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. And then Acts, written by who? Luke. So he has that. He has that all going for him. Which of the Gospels was the last written? Anybody know? John. John, I found this chart. I can't recommend this book enough. This is one of these like books that as I read through it, I'm just like, that's neat. I didn't know that. And I didn't make that connection before. John was most likely written in the late first century, written by John the Apostle. And it was probably written from Ephesus, but he's going to write it much later. The first of the Gospels that's going to be written is Mark. Mark and Matthew. Mark's probably in the mid, is what this guy's saying, and Matthew's probably in the late 60s. And Matthew's one of those interesting ones that somebody said Aramaic. They are pretty sure that it was originally written in Greek, but there might have been like a Cliff's Notes version earlier circulating that was written in Aramaic. But once again, we don't know because we don't have it. But we do know we've seen Greek as we go through. So, last book written. Everybody knows the last book written. What's that? Revelation. Yeah. So, or I'm going to start calling it the Apocalypse. That's a more fun word to say. But so Revelation was the last one written. So as you look through this, one of the things that's going to happen is it's going to be confirmed by church fathers such as that guy, Jerome and Augustine. We're going to have letters and writings from these people that say this was here. And interestingly enough, we have a letter. Let me see if I can find that letter. We have a letter from a guy named Eusinius, I believe his name was. I had it here. Where he is, he's an early church leader, and he writes, Eusebius, I think I'm probably saying that wrong, but what we know is that he writes a letter to one of his colleagues in the, let me make sure I'm saying the years right. In the 300s. He writes a letter to one of his colleagues before the Nicaea and all that stuff, and he says, hey, we have these books. And he lays out the books. And the, or he doesn't actually name them all, but he says, we have these books. And that's a pretty good idea that the church has all agreed on this to begin with. But then three church councils, including the Synod of Carthage, which synod is just a fancy word for what? Meeting. Okay? They're going to pull together and they're going to have these ideas. Now, some of the stuff you can sort of start to see the church sort of wandering. Because what we're going to see, for instance, the Council of Nicaea talks about ordaining bishops, but not just bishops, ordaining bishops that are under other bishops. And so you're going to start to sort of see the church wander. So you got to be a little careful and very critical of what you read out of these councils and these synods, because some of them, before the Constantine calls the first one, they had regional synods. They had regional things where the church leaders would get together and then go back to their congregations and say, hey, this is what we talked about. This is what we heard. And then they would lead, as we see now, the way that we have things. Is that any elders in here? I know my dad said he talks to fellow elders at other congregations quite a bit, not in an authoritative way, but more in a way of, hey, this is an issue we're facing. Are you all facing that? And sort of getting the ideas, and then they go back and then they make the decisions as local individual churches. So you got some interesting stuff there. And then let's take the last couple minutes. Like I've told y'all, I'm a geography guy. Everything can be traced back to geography. Geography affects everything we do. It affects what we're wearing. It affects how we live. Geography matters here. So in 325, this is what we're pretty sure is the expansion of Christianity. Okay? In 325, you've got all the way from, I don't have the pointer, but all the way it's into Mesopotamia, which if you know much about it, actually, is the pointer back there, Alan? Can I get it real quick? This is going to be way easier. Oh, by the way, him taking this picture made me remember this. This is hosted. This PowerPoint is now hosted on the website, and I think it's sealed. Click it, it'll highlight. Oh, nice. Apparently my clicker does that. But this is hosted, so if there's anything you want to see closer, or if there's anything you want to look at and make sure, check the spelling, because some of these guys' names, as I say them, probably I'm saying them wrong. Curtis is going to get them right, but I'm definitely going to get them wrong. It's hosted, it's in the sermon section, and it's just called How We Got the Bible PowerPoint, and you can take a look at it. Now, it will probably change a little bit, but as I change it and update things, there we go. So over here in Mesopotamia, I always ask the question, why is it here, and why is it over there, but why is that chunk in the middle gone? Those people just didn't want to hear about Christianity? It's a desert. Yeah, it's exactly right. And it falls to one of those things where the most simple explanation is usually the best. The interesting one, that's cool, I didn't know I could do that. What we're going to see is here, you got the northern Africa all the way down to Egypt. Why is it like this here, but why does Egypt go down like that? What's that? The Nile. It is literally, it follows the Nile down. There is nothing there. There is nothing there. And so it follows the Nile down, and it's there. And so most of our religious, most of the texts that we have, a lot of them are found in Egypt as well as the Sinai Peninsula because of how the weather conditions are just perfect for preservation. Okay? Same deal here. Big chunks there. What is this line that they're showing you, by the way? That's the border of the Roman Empire, okay? And in 325, Rome is gonna be okay, but they're starting to realize that they can't control that. You actually see some of it crossing over into the Germans, the Germanic peoples. This area here is going to resist them famously. The area here, by the way, what's that? What's the big yellow spots there that don't get filled in? That's the Alps. Okay, there's not a lot of. I mean, there are some things there, but we just don't know. When I tried to look at how he formulated this map, he basically looked at what cities had it and then sort of filled in the lines from where it was and then avoided geography. Because sometimes how a map is made is the sort of the same thing. Up here in Spain, I tried to figure out why this isn't going to be a Christian area in 325, other to say that it's pretty much like the backwoods of Rome at that point. There's not a lot there. It is the far-flung area of the Bible and they're just, of the Mediterranean, and they're just not going to really go with it that much. And then moving on up into, you can actually see up here Christianity spread in 325 into the British Isles. So that got us where we need to be. Curtis is going to start up with the Vulgate, which he'll have a lot more information about that. Like I always say, if you have any questions, feel free to catch me, catch Curtis. Catch Curtis first, then come find me if you can't find him. And thanks a lot, guys. Hopefully you learned something.